This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. It is June the 30th. My name is Eddie Lindenstein, of course. Now, before I get started with today's interview, I want to make sure I thank the patrons of the podcast. Let me give a big shout out to Valerie and John, Brooke, Carrie, Jason, Colette, Matthew, Mindy, Irina, Kelly, Tony, Francisco, Michael, Victoria, Anthony, Jen, and Nate, Christina, Ross, Julie, Brian, Arnie, Barb, and Kim. Thank you all so much for your continued support of the podcast. It would honestly, at this point, it would not be around without your support. So today I've got an interview I think I've only done an interview with a couple of people from Australia since this podcast started. And today is one of those days. I have Sarah DeKeeley. DeKeeley? Did I pronounce that correctly on the line?
Yes.
From Brisbane.
You have.
You and I were talking off air a couple of minutes ago about that I had been to Australia. So 9 years ago, my wife and I did so we live in Seattle, and we went to Sydney, we went to Cairns, we went to Uluru, and we did the flight from Seattle to Portland, Portland to LA, LA to Sydney. So that was a really long that was like 33 hours or something like that. Got to Sydney, spent 4 days there, 5 days there, and then we went to Uluru for 3 days. And the deep part of the Australian outback is it's hot, and there were a lot of spiders, and like that was kind of what I remember the most about. And that I ate kangaroo, and I ate gator, and I ate rattlesnake, and I ate like a lot of things I never would have otherwise eaten. And then we went to Cairns for 3 or 4 days, and we swam the Great Barrier Reef. And I love your part of the world, so kudos to you for where you live.
Thank you. It is beautiful. It's a beautiful spot. We're very fortunate. We've been very lucky in many ways. Also, you know, especially when it comes to COVID, we've been very protected. I mean, we've had COVID here as well, but the numbers have been very low. I mean, we've just had 2 cases of COVID, and the government's just gone into lockdown for 3 days. The whole city has gone into lockdown for 2 cases. So, I'm quite, you know, happy that the government is quite proactive and, you know, just they care about what happens. And yeah, other than that, we've had a pretty normal life pretty much most of this year as well as last year. It's just been a couple of days or maybe a week here or there where we've had a bit of lockdown, but that's about it, really.
Well, y'all are doing a great job. I watch with envy. And when you say, gosh, a couple of cases, shut it down. I mean, we'd have 200,000, 300,000, 400,000 in a day, and it felt like not a lot was changing. But I'm not going to stay on the COVID and the politics talk for long, because my opinions have ruffled feathers of listeners before, and I've gotten plenty of hate mail in the past year about that kind of stuff. So, you know, it is what it is. What we are here to talk about today, though, you are a TMS therapist, TMS psychotherapist, and you've got a lot of experience in this field. And you sent me a message. I'm going back and I'm looking at the date. It was several weeks ago. It was earlier on in June, but us really getting a time on the calendar. And one of the things that you had said is that you had talked about how you had suffered from TMS for a long time, but you had found ultimately that dance and yoga and golf, really moving, got you, you know, helped heal you. It helped you heal amongst other things. And so I want to talk a lot about that stuff, because that's not like normal vernacular. When a therapist comes to me and they say, I'm interested in being interviewed, there's no real talk about movement. So I'm excited to talk about that kind of stuff with you. But tell us about you, you know, just you as a person, you as a current day, and then we'll venture back and we'll kind of get the, you know, the original story.
Sure. So I've been working within the field of mental health for over 10 years now. And I started experiencing TMS unconsciously. I didn't actually know it was TMS at the time when I was a teenager. And looking back, I can now see that I even experienced it as a child. And once I, you know, finished my degree and started working within the sector, I started to notice that there were a lot of people who experienced chronic pain, you know, people with mental health issues, people who had a history of trauma, which I now believe is pretty much most people. And I started to also pay attention to what was happening to me, because I You know, I had these patterns of being the people pleaser and, you know, caring a lot about what other people thought, doing everything I could to make things better for everybody else, being the peacemaker, being the responsible one. And I noticed that while I was working within my sector that I developed, these symptoms as well. You know, I went through everything from 3 months of being bed-rested for back pain and going to the doctors, getting painkillers, as well as visiting the chiropractor and going to the physio, you know, the usual. Went through, tinnitus as well as TMJ, neck pain, you know, the whole works, acid refluxes, hip pain. There's really very few things that I haven't been through when it comes to TMS.
How old were you when you were going through, if you don't mind my asking, when you were going through sort of the crux of it, when you were talking about, you know, being out for several days and painkillers and all that kind of stuff? Like what age are we talking about?
So I was in my early 30s.
Okay.
When it got really bad. When I was younger, I'll just go back a little bit. When I was a teenager, I developed an eating disorder. And I now see that that was very much TMS related because, you know, when you develop an eating disorder, you're very much trying to cope with, I guess, an environment that is incredibly stressful. And prior to that, when I was a baby, I have memories of, just having really bad stomach pains. I actually struggled a fair bit to go to the bathroom or have bowel movements. Yeah. It was quite an issue. I remember my parents taking me to the doctor several times or giving me all kinds of different things so that I could have bowel movements. I just really struggled with that. And from that, I developed this unhealthy relationship with food because I just didn't want to eat because it hurt so much to have a bowel movement. And so that was when I was a child. And then once I became a teenager, I went through the whole process of, you know, eating issues and eating disorders for quite a few years. It was about a decade.
Yeah.
And then once I'd recovered from that, I saw a therapist and recovered from that. And it was many years after, I would say maybe about 6-7 years after, that I started to develop the back pain.
Okay.
It happened while I was traveling. I met my husband while I was traveling in Spain, and I didn't really want to stay there. I was happy to just do, you know, a year of traveling around, learning the language, just taking a break from my own profession and just doing this thing that I called eat, pray, love, you know.
But before we continue, though, did you started to get this, you know, these back issues or these other ailments? Was the eating disorder gone at that point? Like, cause some people have this thing where they kind of do the whack-a-mole thing, right? They get rid of one symptom and then they get another. Is that what happened to you?
No, the eating disorder was actually gone. I had, obviously seen a therapist. I'd recovered from it, but I think when it comes to things like eating issues and eating disorders, it's a very, it's a very sensitive condition in the sense that we're always subjected to food. So, and now living in a culture where you're constantly told what's good for you, what's not good for you. You need to eat this. That's bad. And this is how you need to, what you need to look like. You have to constantly check in with yourself.
Yeah.
It's like, it takes daily awareness so that you don't get caught up in this, in the conditioning. And so I was quite aware. I was very aware of that at the time. So it wasn't that I still had an eating disorder and then started to develop back pain. Not at all. This was many years after. And it happened because I felt stressed in my environment. I felt trapped. I didn't really want to stay any longer in that country that I was visiting at the time. There were a lot of challenges of being there. That honeymoon phase of, when you go traveling first, that honeymoon phase had ended. And I just felt that it was time to leave. But because I had met someone who was you know, asking me to stay. And there was a part of me that still, you know, very big part of me that was still people pleasing and not trusting myself fully. I decided to just stay put. And the challenges, you know, became bigger. I couldn't really work there. I was struggling financially. I was missing Australia. I was missing the freedom that we have here in many ways. And the language was also very difficult. It was a barrier for me. The culture was very different. So I felt like I had created a bit of a prison for myself. And even though I could just make a decision and leave, I really, you know, I was still stuck in playing this good girlfriend, good whatever, good girl syndrome, as I call it.
Good,
pushing through.
Good girl syndrome. I love that. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Yeah, instead of TMS, I had TNS.
Yeah.
You know what that stands for, right?
I don't know.
It's called, forgotten what the T stands for, but it's NICE syndrome, obviously, okay. N and S, but it's called something like terminal NICE syndrome or something like that. I read it somewhere.
That's funny. Yeah. That's funny. So you said you're feeling kind of trapped, like you're feeling sort of stuck.
Yeah, I did. And I started to get, you know, sciatica pain, mm-hmm. which increased and got really, really bad. Went and saw a really good chiropractor there. I saw him twice a week and he kept cracking my body. And then I said to him, look, I'm just getting worse from all the cracking. And he said, yeah, I don't think the cracking is necessarily going to help you anymore because you're not a big build, you're a small build. So I'm just going to use one of these little nerve activator. I don't know. They've got these little tools that they use.
Yeah.
I did that for about, I think it was around 8 weeks. And then he said to me, and it was twice a week, and he said to me, look, I don't know what else to do. I don't know why you're not getting better. I really don't know what's going on with you because you should be fine by now. And I wasn't. Emotionally, I felt quite angry. I was suppressing the anger because, you know, I was stuck at home, stuck in a country where I didn't have any friends. I could barely walk or do anything. And I was living in this little neighborhood outside of Madrid with obviously my boyfriend at the time. And feeling a sense of guilt that I didn't really want to be there. And, you know, he was very much trying his best to be accommodating, you know, and kind of pay the bills, take care of me and so on. But I just wasn't happy. I really didn't want to be there. And it's so interesting how trapped I was in these belief systems that I had at the time, you know, that I can't do what I want to do. I can't trust my own inner wisdom. I have to do what's right. Yeah. I have to do what, you know, what's expected of me. And it wasn't until I started to, you know, do some meditation and just do some breathing exercises that I got a bit of relief from the pain, but it was still there. Until I reached a point where I had a conversation with my mom and she said, look, you just can't keep doing this to yourself. You need to go. I have a feeling that you need to just leave. That's not the place for you. And I kept saying, but mom, how am I going to travel with this back pain? And so eventually I ended up listening to my gut and to my mom and I went back to Australia.
What pointed you to the breathing exercises and the meditation? Do you recall?
You know what? It was a moment of surrender. I kind of went because I literally couldn't do much. I would maybe walk a couple of meters a day and I would stay the rest of the day in bed. It was a really horrible time in my life. And I would cry for hours. And there was a book that I read at the time by Gary Zukav. And he it was called The Seed of the Soul. And he the things that he said in that book really moved me. And I realized that, you know what? I can't keep fighting. I can't keep fighting what's happening. I need to just surrender. There's nothing else I can do right now.
Yeah.
And that was a bit of a, you know, that gave me relief, that surrendering process. Just, you know, I'm quite into the teachings of Eckhart Tolle since then. because I really believe that the more you fight what is, the more you're going to feel that pain. And that's the thing that was happening to me. I was very focused on the pain as opposed to focusing on all the other things that were happening around me. So what I started to do was, as soon as I got a bit of relief, I would go down to this little communal garden area and I would sit there and I would focus on the flowers and the beauty of those flowers. And I would say, wow, that is so beautiful. I'm so grateful that I can see these things, you know, because when you're in severe pain, and for me, this is how the experience was. I was in so much pain that my whole world was about the pain. And so reading that book helped me to feel a sense of, you know, relief, yeah, or just, as, like I said, the surrender. But then I started to pay attention to, because I had spent weeks in bed, I'd forgotten about the beauty of my natural surroundings, you know. I'd forgotten about how amazing it can feel to just look at the sky or just to, I don't know, just appreciate the little things. And that was what started to give me relief, you know, appreciating the little things, looking at the beautiful flowers around me. Even though, obviously, my mind kept bringing me back to the pain and the sensations, I kept thinking, you know what, I'm so tired of focusing on the sensation that I'm just, for now, because I know this is going to be short-lived, me sitting on this bench, I'm just going to focus on enjoying this experience.
Creating a little bit of separation, sounds like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was really eye-opening for me. That whole experience is what brought me to this practice I have today, which is very much, you know, living in the now, living in the present moment, focusing on not always the pleasure, but just, you know, the beauty that you can find in things. Mm-hmm. I do that still. You know, I go out to nature and I just look at the trees. I go really close to the leaves and I just take photos of the leaves. And I'm like, this is so beautiful.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was my, you know, initial experience with, I guess, not initial experience, but you know, that experience where you go, okay, this is definitely TMS.
Yep.
However, at the time, I didn't know it was TMS. Once I got back to Australia and I went to see a friend of mine who's a chiropractor, she had these books by Dr. Sano in her house. And I got very curious. I walked towards the books and I said, what's this? And she said, oh, I just got these books. You can borrow them if you want. And once I started to read them, I just couldn't put them down.
Had you been in contact with that friend of yours throughout the?
No.
No? Okay.
No,
so she wasn't even really aware of all the stuff that had been going on.
No, nothing. Nothing. I had no idea it was TMS. If I had known it was TMS, I would have probably felt better a lot earlier, because it was almost close to, what was it, between, well, 3 months in bed, literally constantly in bed, but then also 3 months kind of in and out of the house, but not really going far, not really exercising. I did, towards the end, before I left Madrid, I did start something that's called function running, which is when I heard Wayne Dyer, or I think it was in a book or in one of his YouTube videos, talk about function running, where, you know, you just start to run very gently while you still have, you know, your entire foot on the ground. And it helps your mind to kind of get into that mindset of, you know, I'm an athlete. I exercise. I love to exercise. This feels really good. I can do this. And so function running was really my way of getting back into exercise.
Did you have any, you know, physical hot, like earlier on, I had talked about that message that you had sent about, you know, you talked about golf and dance, stuff like that. Yeah. Did you have hobbies that involved, you know, physicality or anything like that before you were like laid up in bed or taking painkillers?
Absolutely.
Or whatever?
Okay. Absolutely. I've always been very active. I used to go to the gym. Even when I was in Spain, I used to go to the gym. I used to dance, you know, I love doing, I still do. I love doing Zumba and other kinds of dance. But once I got the pain, everything stopped. You know, my whole focus was on the pain. If anything, I think, you know, I really got caught up in this victim mentality, which, you know, I wasn't aware of at the time, where I would almost dwell on it, you know, because I just so desperately wanted nurture.
Yeah.
I wanted someone to take care of me. I wanted someone to meet my emotional needs. And yet, you know, my partner at the time, he didn't know how to do that. I didn't even know how to do that, right? So he did his best to meet my physical needs, you know, to just pay the bills and so on while I was going through that process. But yeah, absolutely, I was active. And I think a big part of the grief that I went through was that I couldn't move.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't do the things I wanted to do.
I had always misunderstood grief as being just somebody died or somebody passed away or you lost a pet or something like that. And later on, like much long after I had read Sarno's books, because when my issues got really bad, it was when I was, I had to stop weightlifting, like competitive weightlifting, in order to care for my post-operative shoulder injury that I had had, which still could have been TMS. But, and then the variety of issues that I just started having. And there was this long that I recognize now as a grieving process, but you know, only makes that the weight of the situation and the toll that it takes on you even greater, right? And maybe it's not something that you were. And were you a psychotherapist this whole time, or was that a career that came after you read Sarno stuff?
No, I actually was trained as a mental health social worker. Okay. So I was working within the sector prior to getting introduced to, you know, Sarno's books, and that was just a couple of years before. So I would say around maybe 4 years before that I, or maybe less, around three or four years, yeah, that I was in the sector. And then I got introduced to Sarno's books.
And I'm always really curious, like people that come from that line of work, I guess how does that, like, is part of the training or the teaching that you go through to acquire licensures or certifications or get those degrees or anything like that, like, do they talk about mind, body, pain? Is that a part of the conversation at all or not at all?
No. And I think that's one of the biggest issues that we have, is that our educational system does not necessarily teach about the effects of, you know, stress, yeah, emotional stress on our body. And, you know, we know that it doesn't happen within medical schools. I have worked within the same university where I got my education. I actually went back and worked there as a counselor for, you know, a lot of the medical students. And they were completely oblivious to things like mind-body disorders and TMS. That there's no curriculum, you know, that talks about even the effects of trauma.
Yeah.
And how that, you know, how that affects the body. Because I do believe that a lot of us, if not the majority of us, have experienced traumatic experiences. And it doesn't have to be anything as, you know, as horrific as being physically abused or going through, I don't know, a horrific accident or some kind of loss. It could be something as simple, you know, and I'm saying simple in brackets, yeah, as not having your emotional needs met. You know, I had a client who told me, that, you know, he had this memory of being around 6 years old and just asking his dad one day, hey dad, I'm really scared about death. You know, what is death? Like, he had these questions about death and dying. And his father looked at him and said, stop thinking about that. Just go inside and make yourself a hot chocolate, you know? And remembering that was incredibly painful for him. And he wouldn't have remembered that prior to our session because, you know, when we first talked about his childhood, he was like, my childhood was great. I had no issues. And it right. wasn't until we actually dived in that he realized that actually, yeah, there wasn't a lot of emotional availability. And what does that actually mean, you know, for someone to be there with you as you experience feelings of fear or feelings of pain or whatever it is that, you know, comes up, because it's only when we're alone with our pain that it becomes traumatizing.
Yeah. My oldest daughter is like fascinated by death. Every time we drive by a cemetery and he's like, she recently, so my wife, lost her dad when she was two or three, like doesn't really have any memories cause she was that young. But my daughter found out about this recently, you know, cause she had asked, How come grandpa's dad's dad, but where is grandpa mom's dad? And then I had told her that, you know, he had passed away in a car accident when your mom was just a little girl. And it's, she, when we got home later that day, she went out to the backyard and she was literally, she found these like special rocks and she was burying special rocks as a memorial to him and like saying that she like really missed him. And I was thinking like, I mean, he died in like 1985, you know, but that, what that tells me is that, you know, a 6-year-old does think about and interpret death, right? So the things that you're talking about with your client, I don't find surprising at all.
Yeah, I mean, the majority of the people I work with, if not everyone I work with, we go through their childhood experiences. And there's pretty much, and it's not that there's, it's anyone's fault. Yeah, I just want to clarify that it's not about blaming the parents. They did their best, right?
Yeah.
They did the best. And it's very hard for parents to always be emotionally available. It's a very difficult role. I mean, you've got kids, you know, and especially if you're a single parent or there's other challenges that you have to deal with, whether it's health issues or financial and so on. But what's important here is that you kind of inquire about those things. You know, you don't just brush it off by saying, oh, I had a great childhood. You know, my parents were great. It's more about, you know, if you inquire into what actually really happened and get to the truth of the matter, that's what sets you free, because you get to see, okay, how did those experiences really influence me, influence how, you know, that sense of self that gets developed at that age, or, you know, within that environment, belief systems that get developed within that time. Because that's what you want to get to. And once you realize what they are, and that's when you can change them, you know, the things that have been, I guess, the unhealthy belief systems, as well as the things that, you know, no longer serve you. I mean, I used to think that being a certain way is part of who I am. It's part of my personality. You know, I am this way. I'm very responsible. I'm very, you know, I care about what being organized and always saying the right thing and caring about other people. I actually took pride in being a certain way. And it wasn't until I realized that, wait a minute, this is, I'm not always this way. You know, there are times when, you know, like with my husband, I can be a bit bitchy sometimes, you know?
Yeah.
And that's okay too, you know. I actually think it's really healthy to sometimes have a bitchy partner, because you want them to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
You know, you want them to speak their truth. You don't want them to be pleasing, because that's when people start to get sick, you know. And I'm not referring to being inconsiderate. I'm not referring to being unkind. You know, I'm not referring to losing that part of you that has empathy and compassion. Not at all. But I think when you can truly be compassionate for yourself, then, you know, you really just, you give up the roles, you know, the roles that we take on.
Yeah.
This is who I am. And you start to get to the core of who you really are, the truth of who you really are. Because a lot of what I've come to realize is that much of the fear and the pain that we experience, even when we go through, especially with TMS, is trauma related. So in order to heal the trauma, we have to work on building a newfound sense of self that's no longer being navigated by, you know, these narratives and belief systems that were unconsciously imposed upon us as children. And that's kind of how I see this whole experience with TMS.
I want to go back to... I kind of feel like we got sort of the incomplete version of... Your friend was a chiropractor. You found these Sarno books at her place. But like, you know, then we fast forwarded to the career stuff.
Yes, I know. We've jumped around.
Yeah. I mean, what happened? Like, you read these books, and how did you know that this was you? And mm-hmm. I'm sure it wasn't just that simple. Maybe it was. What sort of methods did you put in place? Did you then see a psychotherapist? Did you start to be like, gosh, how did I miss this in my line of work? Like, kind of take me through that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So once I read the books, I knew this was me. You know, I knew that it was about me. Like, I fell into the category of the typical TMS personality types. And so once I read the books, I started to get more information about it. I did start to see someone. She wasn't necessarily a TMS therapist, but she worked a lot with mind-body disorders and just was very aware of them. And so I worked with her for a bit, but a lot of, I guess my own healing came from implementing, you know, the teachings of mindfulness, the teachings of people like, you know, not just Steve Ozanich. I read his book and I found that to be really informative and helpful. I started to, you know, practice self-compassion a lot more, to be kinder to myself. Now, this stuff wasn't easy, hey? I mean, I'm just, you know, giving you the quick run here, but it was very hard. I had to deal with my ego, and that's a lifelong journey, right?
Yeah.
And for me, you know, just taking a look at all the things that that my ego, I guess, was doing in terms of how I was, you know, believing all of the stories and giving into some of those thoughts that I had about myself or about the world around me or how I needed to be, you know. So everything from, you know, a need to be good, you know, to the point of sacrificing my own needs, the perfectionistic tendencies, you know, the self-critical mind that I had and the really high standards that I had set for myself, that inner sense of inadequacy, you know, that fuels the perfectionism. I had to really look at those things. And I did that both through therapy as well as just, you know, daily self-inquiry, worrying a lot about what could go wrong, you know, a need to excel. I started to actually slow down a lot more in my work.
Yeah.
And I still do. I'm not very loud about my work because I just, you know, work-life balance has become incredibly important for me.
Yep.
You know, giving up these ideas about what a professional needs to be like, you know, and letting go of a lot of that sense of responsibility, especially for other people's emotions and feelings. And I noticed that even in my relationship with my husband, where even you know, with my family members, I now am very much aware that I'm not responsible for what they're feeling. Even once I speak my truth, if something comes up for them, that's something that, you know, they need to look at. And I'm happy to support them to kind of look at that. But it's not my, you know, for me to carry.
Yeah.
It's not my responsibility. And so this stuff isn't easy, you know, it really isn't easy, but
there's been a theme. Yeah. There's been a theme that you've kind of been talking about for the last few minutes that kind of put some stuff into perspective, things that I don't think I've talked about with anybody on this podcast before or any other guest has brought up. And that's the ego side of it that you were saying, like, have to let go of that. And there's this really great video. Gosh, if I remember to send it to you, hopefully I remember to send it to you. And if it comes to you, you know, a week from now, hey, Eddie never sent me that video he was talking about, please message me and tell me to send it to
you.
So Jim Carrey, like, you know, he's a Canadian actor and he's big in the United States. I don't know how big he is around the world, but he was a big star in the 1990s. And there's a really great video where he's just kind of talking about he read a whole bunch of the Eckhart Tolle stuff too, and it was really moving for him. And he had this really good quote. The entire video is him really talking about how so many of us play a character. You know, we're so like rigid in the way that we're thinking. Like an example, you gave some examples earlier, but like an example for me is like, you know, the do-goodist and the superhero and the person that never makes the mistakes. Like that's like me. That's like who I am, like a movie character, right? So he's saying the separation of, you know, who really is Jim Carrey. I'm always putting on this mask. I'm always trying to be this actor. I'm always trying to be this thing, you know, and we all show up in the world that way. And towards
I've
the end,
I've seen that, Eddie. I've
oh, you have that. Seen that. Okay. Awesome.
Yeah, I actually posted it, I think a couple of weeks ago. It's what really exists.
Yeah. 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 That's so cool.
Yeah.
Cause when he specifically says, I have a lot of egoic attachments, that's what I keep thinking about when you brought that up, is that like, we have kind of these pieces of our personality or bits that we hold on to that are like, you know, when you can get to a point, again, like you said, it's not easy, but when you can get to a point of really stripping those things away, it's like, what the hell is even the point of me sort of grasping on to this stuff? And that sounds like it's a lot of what you're talking about, being able to like strip that away. Now, can you just give a I guess give a separation or maybe any sort of commentary you have. Something Sarno is pretty adamant about in his books is that you don't have to change your personality or change anything about you. But what we're talking about is being able to identify that there are these characteristics that could be holding you back in these kinds of ways. Is there separation? Like, did you go through this big, you know, change? I know you said you added some characteristics. You know, it's not my responsibility about how you feel, basically, but just kind of talk about reconciling that a little bit.
Yeah, look, I have to say I disagree a little bit with Sarno there. Mm-hmm. I think we do have to let go of some parts of us that have become a part of our personality, because our personality developed, you know, or starts to develop during childhood. And a lot of it is based on the role models that we have around us, the environment that we live in, because there's no way of escaping that we're all subject to our environment. And, you know, as adults, a lot of times we're still holding on to our, I guess, ideas of who we need to be, what we need to do in order to kind of survive this world or to get that love, attention from others, appreciation, admiration, and so on. And those behaviors don't serve us anymore as adults. You know what I mean? And so I do believe that there are certain parts of our personality that we do need to let go of. And that's definitely been the case for me, you know? Because the personality itself is a defensive structure that we develop to manage our pain. You know, much of what we consider to be our personality is an overlay of our true self. You know, for example, when I was a child, and I come from a background of severe trauma that I haven't spoken about, but I've written about in my book, I was a very insecure, highly sensitive, fearful, and incredibly anxious child, to the point where I did develop those stomach issues that I mentioned at a very early, you know, young age. I was immensely pleasing, trying to, you know, stop the fighting between my parents or wanting them to just always, you know, wanting a peaceful home, yearning to be praised, yearning to be seen and loved by my parents. I never chose to be this way. I certainly wasn't born this way. I don't believe that. These personality traits developed as a result of trying to soothe my pain and to survive my environment. So, you know, that was my personality, but it wasn't my person. It's not who I am, right? So, and I really believe in that. I think you've got to work on letting go of some of the things that no longer serve you.
I'm so glad that you said that, by the way. I think that, earlier on, I had kind of fallen into this trap a little bit of like, whatever Sarno says is gospel. However, I know that over the last few years for me, and I can chalk some of it up just to like going from the age of 29, when a lot of this stuff was getting really bad, to now 35, where I am, and sort of just kind of how I see myself in the world overall. But I've kind of struggled in the last few years with like, okay, well, if Sarno says that you're not supposed to change at all, but I'm like, these other parts of me don't seem like they're really, you know, me going and having this rigidity around just life in general and being so stuck in my ways and, you know, just stubborn in general. I'm like, doesn't seem like it's a good thing to change that. Like, if that's one of the things that's really holding me back, like, what's the point of keeping it around? So I'm glad that you delve into that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I honestly, I think Dr. Sarno is amazing. I think he highlighted something that is, you know, revolutionary. But a lot of also what he highlighted has been there for many years prior, you know, the whole concept of mind-body disorders and how our experiences influence our body. And, you know, I think our belief systems influence our body. Louise Hay, I think, was one of the first kind of pioneers in writing about it. And one of the things that has, in a way, backfired in her case is the affirmations, because people are like, well, I can't just say these affirmations and then feel better. Because of course you can't, you know, when there are limiting belief systems in your mind that have been there for many, many years based on your upbringing and environment, your mind is just going to spit that affirmation out, yep. You know. So that's why I think psychotherapy is so important when it comes to, you know, the TMS journey. I mean, I'm now in my 40s and it took me many years to get to a place. And I still am in that place of, you know, doing the work, self-inquiry every day, you know, mindfulness and mindful breathing. One of the things, one of my favorite books is this book by Bessel. I don't know if you've heard of it. Mm-hmm. The Body Keeps the Score or something.
Oh, yeah, I've heard the name. I've heard of the name. I haven't read the book, though.
It's one of the best books I've ever read. And one of the quotes he's got in that book that I love is that he says, beneath the surface of all the protective parts of trauma survivors, there exists an undamaged essence, a self that is confident, curious, and calm, a self that has been sheltered from destruction by the various protectors that have emerged in their efforts to ensure survival. And once those protectors trust that it is safe to separate, the self will spontaneously emerge and the parts can be enlisted in the healing process. And I think what he meant by that is that, when we're born, as children, you look at a baby is full of confidence, mm-hmm. They pull up their shirts and they're like, look at my belly, and they kiss themselves in the mirror, and they're like, they cry whenever they want something and demand it. They demand the attention, and they're full of that confidence. They're full of that aliveness that, they are true to who they are, right? But it's the conditioning, it's the environment that starts to influence us where we lose that sense of self, that yeah. essence that, Bessel talks about here, that is very much curious and confident and calm and, not so critical of self and others, not so judgmental. And I think our journey, I know for me, my journey in life is really about shedding light on that awareness, constantly bringing awareness to that parts of myself that is caught up in judgment, caught up in, my ideas of how life should be as opposed to how life is, trusting that unfolding. And, I think Jim Carrey in his video pretty much refers to that, that life is living you. Yep. You're not living life.
Yep.
Because, and that's something I've come to realize too. I had to, once I became aware of TMS and I had to go dive deeper within myself, that's when I started to see how much of this conditioning, that I had, that had become a part of who I am, the whole caring about what my body looks like all the time, putting my sense of self, my self, worthiness into how much money I make, how I seem, how I appear in front of people, or what they think of me, or how much I do for someone, or how they look at me as this incredible, amazing, whatever therapist who's just helped them.
Yeah.
There's a lot of ego even in the parts of us that we think is egoless.
Yeah.
So absolutely. I think the TMS journey, and I see it in my clients, every day I work with people with this stuff, is about, it's pretty much like a spiritual journey in the sense that, and I'm not referring to religion, I'm not referring to, because I know spiritual, the word is quite loaded.
Yep.
What I'm referring to is that connection with your true self, with your essence, getting back to that. And that's why I love doing things now that bring me back to that space. I do the dancing, the Zumba dancing, I do the Samba dancing, I make sure I play things like golf, I paint a lot. It just helps me connect to that child that I wouldn't say that I once were, because I pretty much lost a lot of that at an early age,
yeah.
because of my environment, but to the child that I would have wanted to be. I'm kind of now giving myself that happy childhood again, if that makes sense.
I mean, if you would have told me that 5 or 6 years ago, I'd be riding an electric skateboard as a hobby all the time, like as a 35-year-old man, and people pitch me shit and say, hey, you're 35, like as if like being in my mid-30s just mean that I don't do anything fun or exciting or, whatever anymore. But I'm like, yeah, like I ride that thing down the street or I hit the trails or whatever. And it's like, 10-year-old kids that see me think I'm the most badass dad with my long flowing hair. My hair is about as long as yours. That long flowing hair and a beard and tattoos and this electric skateboard wearing Vans and all this stuff. And I'm like, it's fun. Like, that's like that. That's like the essence of life that I think that so many people. I mean, in Sarno's books, and he says that the age of responsibility, that sort of like 30 to 60-year-old, where it seems mm-hmm. like people have a lot of predisposition to pain. And he's like, it's not because of an age thing, because suddenly they get past that age of responsibility and the chronic pain levels seem to drop, which wouldn't make any sense. So I think stuff like that's pretty interesting. Now we're getting down to the last few minutes. And this has honestly flown by a lot. I'm keep trying to pick out like, and I would love to do a part two at some point.
I was just thinking that, Eddie.
Yeah.
we have a lot more to talk about.
I had asked earlier about, you were you doing psychotherapy? Were you in school? Were you practicing whatever before any of this stuff happened? And you had a career in this. This wasn't like where you were a teacher and then this stuff happened and kind of upended your life and you became a psychotherapist. You were doing that all along. So I imagine that you shifted gears to get into like TMS specific work. That's certainly how your website reads. To me, it seems like a no-brainer, but what, you know, you kind of had this shift in perspective in your life and then obviously changed kind of what you were doing, doing for a living. Just kind of talk about that transition from going from a mental health counselor, a social worker, into what it is that you're doing now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, when I first got into this sector, I saw this stuff. You know, I've always seen this stuff. People with mental health issues have physical, issues, physical pain, physical symptoms, whether it's illness related, whether it's chronic pain related. But I never, I didn't put two and two together. I wasn't trained to do that, right? And it wasn't until I went through that experience and then read Sarno's books and had that kind of awakening in many ways where I realized, oh my goodness, of course, it's all connected. You can't separate the mind from the body. You just can't do it. It's impossible. And that's when I started to, focus a lot more on, reading the books. I got very much specialized in trauma recovery. I started to educate myself even more about it and just dive deeper and deeper into this and realize that, you know what, there's no way of supporting people with mental health issues or TMS unless you support them through their traumas, unless you help them to look back and dive deep and go within and look at everything from, their upbringing, their belief systems, their sense of boundaries, their understanding of their inner child and the reparenting process that's a part of, the therapeutic work. And to get to a place of being able to develop a sense of self that is very much who you really want to be, away from this egoic notions of who you think you are, who you've been told that you should be, how you think you have to be to survive, to get love. And what is survival? We're not just talking about money here. Survival is more than anything, especially for, an infant. It's about connection. It's about love. It's about attention. It's about affection, right? So today, in today's world, if you look at how people think that we can get that, it's all about social media, look at me and look at how awesome I am. So I really believe that these are, deep-seated wounds that many of us have. So for me, that interest helped me get into the work that I'm doing now because I started to really see that all of this stuff is connected. It's not separate.
Are there, as a therapist, this is more for yourself and maybe, if we get back together and do a part two, which I'm hoping you'll say yes to. In fact, maybe I'll ask you on air and then you sort of have to say yes if we can do a part two. I'm always curious, so say that you woke up tomorrow and you started having neck pain or back pain or foot pain or whatever, like you as a therapist and knowing what you know, what are two or three things that you start to integrate into yourself or what, what sort of things would you do for yourself?
So I'm happy to say, and I say happy consciously because I actually think pain is a gift, that I still do get aches and pains. It's no longer chronic in the sense that I don't have them, constantly, but I always do have, my body always talks to me. So if I do push myself, my body will let me know. And I'm totally okay with that. And the ways that I try and support myself through all of this is really incorporating things like I paint, which I never thought I'd do in my 40s. You talk about, what you never thought you'd do in your 30s. Yeah. I never thought I'd be dancing. I'd be doing samba. I'd be doing Zumba. I never thought I'd be doing golf. I'd be doing painting. I've just now recently been asked to do a really big exhibition down the Gold Coast in a couple of days. I never ever thought I would do any of these things in my 40s,
yeah.
which, you know, I didn't even dare to dream it when I was younger. So, you know, for me, things like painting and drawing, and I have workshops that I run for many of my clients around this, because I believe creativity is incredibly powerful. It has the power to heal. You know, when we draw, when we paint, you know, it reveals our feelings, it reveals our thoughts and influences and interests. You know, whenever I paint, I bring forth elements within myself, and I, you know, place it on a canvas and then look at it from a different perspective. You know, I kind of see that, oh, there's a judgmental part of my mind that's telling me that this is ugly. Okay, how can I find the beauty in this? And how can I start to shift it towards a place where I'm actually really happy when I look at it?
Yeah.
And I start from a corner and I work towards that. So things like that really help me. Creativity. I have learned quite a lot about the polyvagal theory, which we haven't had a chance to talk about, and the function of our nervous system. And I teach that to my clients. And I actually have, you know, incorporate a lot of that in my own life, because I believe that to be incredibly important when it comes to healing, understanding your nervous system and how that plays a big role in what actually happens in your physiology. And I also do things like, you know, breath work, meditation. For me, meditation is really just to sit and give myself once or twice a day. I just sit and I do nothing and I just focus on my breathing.
Yeah.
Just how does it feel to be in this body? Because I feel like our focus and attention is so much on what's on the outside that we rarely focus on what is happening within me on the inside. And so I'm trying to, you know, every day to just give myself twice a day where I just, you know, for 10 minutes, I just sit and do that.
You know, one thing that's interesting about what you just said is that and this has happened each of the last two nights, and I imagine it will still continue to happen. When I get stuck on certain things and I just start having like kind of swirling obsessive thoughts isn't the right way, but you know, like you're laying in bed and a bazillion things are going through your head. Like I got to set this reminder and I've got to make sure that like last night I was literally thinking there's a chocolate cake on the counter and the dog is going to pull that thing off of the counter and eat the chocolate cake and kill herself overnight. You know, like, so just a lot of stuff. Like, did I put a bottle of water in the fridge for my morning vitamin drink? You know, like all this stuff.
Yeah.
And I do this kind of inner somatic experiencing exercise with myself that is exactly as you're describing. And just all I'm doing is A, focusing either on breathing, or I'm trying to just imagine like the inside of myself, like just, and that's, it's a tough thing to describe, but like, I mean, within a couple of minutes, those thoughts go away entirely and I'm asleep. It will literally just go from a racing, anxious inducing moment to asleep in a matter of a minute and a half or 2 minutes. And it's just, to me, that's really interesting how fast the switch on the nervous system can work. And maybe we'll get into more of that talking about polyvagal stuff in the future, but that's a lot of what I think about when you describe some of those.
Yeah, absolutely, Eddie. I mean, that's it. You know, I mean, I sometimes just, I do this practice with clients a lot in session where we don't just talk. I also get them to focus on what's happening in their body. And when we do the body scanning and we just go within, and I get them to kind of pay attention to the different body parts as well as their organs. Like, how does it feel to have a heart that's beating for you every second of the day, you know, and to really find a place of appreciation for that heart that's constantly beating, you know? And I really think, you know, I know we're running out of time. I just want to highlight that what I've learned about myself when it comes to this journey of healing is that I'm allowed to my emotions, including anger. I think anger is very healthy because, you know, it teaches us about our boundaries, right? So if you look at animals, if you look at children, when something's not right, they're going to have a little whatever, you know, they might have bark or they might just cry, whatever, because they're trying to express their boundaries. Hey, that's not okay, yeah. Right? So I think that's absolutely healthy. It's only when we hold on to it, when we suppress it, when we project it, that it becomes unhealthy. I've learned that I'm allowed to express my truth in whatever shape or form that it, you know, shows up, and that my journey is my journey. It's no one else's. And I think it's so important that we look at that you know, that, you know, we embrace that it's an individual journey as much as there are similarities, that you don't just keep comparing it to other people. And that as much as we sometimes think that timing could be better or it shouldn't happen, or why is this happening? I really believe that my timing has been, I'm choosing to see timing as perfect.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
everything has really unfolded in a way that has helped me to become a much more loving, compassionate version of myself, who is also now able to support others in getting to that place. So, you know, when we're in that deep, dark place, I know for me, certainly when I was on that bed for 3 months straight, I mean, imagine 3 months, you know, not getting out of the house, thinking that not there's nothing else but this pain. I had, you know, I couldn't see the bigger picture. I didn't know why I was going through that. But once I chose, you know, once I reached a place of just surrendering, that's when the things started to flow again, because all of that has brought me to where I am today. And I just think it's so important for anyone who's listening to this, who is in pain, to just trust where you are. You know, pain is an opening. It's a gateway. It really can be such an incredible teacher.
Yeah.
And a guide. So yeah, I just wanted to highlight that.
Sarah, where can people read more about you or learn more about you aside from the part two that we need to do very soon? Is there, you have a website or something like that?
Yeah, I do have a website. I have two websites. One is my full name, sarahdekeely.com, which is very much focused on my art and creative endeavors. But my clinic is called mentalawakening.com.au. And in terms of my own journey, people can read about it in my book, Coming to Life. It's on Amazon. It's on Abe Books. It's on pretty much every single online bookshop that you can find. And in terms of social media, on Instagram, I have an art account, which is Sarah DK Art. And same thing with Facebook, just usually under that, or Mental Awakening AU.
Awesome. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll have you back here real soon.
Thank you so much, Jed. It was lovely to talk to you. Okay. It's really nice.